Great. We're going to crack straight on with this morning. Quick recap of the story so far. We're only second week in, but if you did miss last week, the Israelites we saw are slaves in Egypt. Pharaoh rules the people, has done so now for many years. God has promised the people through the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they would be a great nation, they'd have a land of plenty to live in, and yet here they were, enslaved in a foreign land. Desperate for freedom, longing for the promises of God to be fulfilled, and crying out to God for rescue, for help, and for mercy. I always like to, as best I can, try and get into as much context of what it would have been like in this particular time. The glory of Egypt's pharaohs was displayed. They believed that they were gods, and they would display their glory through these huge architectural structures. Egypt at the time was encased in 60-foot walls that encircled their cities. Their homes and their public buildings that filled them were all made of bricks. Many of Pharaoh's requirements would require maybe 25 million bricks to build. A skilled brickmaker working at top speed could make about 3,000 bricks in a single day, but he rarely made his quota, but all of the time had someone standing over him who was the taskmaster. An Egyptian writer at the time described the brickmaker like this: he is dirtier than vines or pigs from treading under his mud. His clothes are stiff with clay. His leather belt is going to ruin. Entering into the wind, he is miserable. His sides ache since he must be outside in a treacherous wind. His arms are destroyed with technical work while he eats. What he eats is the bread of his fingers, and he washes himself only once a season. He is simply wretched through and through. This was the life of the Hebrew slave making bricks for Pharaoh. He is simply wretched through and through. And we saw last week, into that context, God heard their cries, and rescue is on its way in the form of Moses and Aaron, and they arrive bringing hope with them. And so we're in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 29. It says this: "Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel, he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and they worshipped." Oh, after all of these years of ruthless slavery, hoping against hope that God would deliver us, he finally announces his deliverance. He doesn't just announce it, there were signs and wonders that accompany this thing. All those years of crying out to God, and he's heard, he's responded. What a God! We saw it last week. He sees their suffering. He remembers his promises. He hears their cry, and he sends Moses. He really is the God of Abraham, who promised to deliver his people, and he's finally come. It was the redemption they had hoped for all of their lives. Moses and Aaron start by going to the people of Israel, and they respond with faith, and they respond with worship. First observation this morning, we've got three. First one is this: God's promises are always true, and his favor is unmerited. God's promise to his people was true. He was in a covenant relationship with them that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In fact, God repeatedly introduces himself as such: "I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," because he's wanting to remind the people not so much about who he is, but who they were. Your identity is descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who I was in covenant with. You are my people. You are mine. I have chosen you. I promised your forefathers I'd make you a great nation, and my promises are always true. We were saying in community group this week that one of the things that really amazed us is that these slaves have been in slavery for 400 years. The current generation were born into slavery, and yet they still held on to these promises. They're living the lives that we've described of slavery, and yet they hadn't abandoned God. If it were me, I'm not sure I'd be quite so faithful. Promises, schmomises, you know, is this really what it means to be in covenant relationship with God? I'm really glad he didn't pick me if this is what it meant. I'd be looking at the Egyptians and not actually wondering if I wouldn't be better off with their gods, because my life isn't working out. But they held on to the promises of God. They didn't stop crying out to God and asking him to deliver on these promises. It seems their prayers have been answered. They listen to Moses. They respond in faith. They respond in worship. The message begins to spread amongst what we think are around 2 million Israelites living in Egypt. What about us? What about you? What are the promises that have been made to you, or maybe that you've maybe given up on? What are the promises that are over this church that maybe we've been in despair about? Where perhaps when it comes to God have you began to feel overlooked? Asking why God? When God? How long God? And now Moses has pitched up. There's a new guy in town, and he's bringing with him hope and a promise and a future. God is about to do something incredible. Can you kind of sense the excitement that these Israelites must have felt? Wow, we haven't felt this excited in ages. All these promises, all this time, we're finally getting out of here. We're finally getting out of slavery. And so we come to this mighty, wonderful, and victorious chapter 5. The victory parades are organized. The bunting is taken down from the loft. The balloons are being blown up. It's party time. We're getting out of here. So let's read about it. Exodus 5, 1 to 14. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, "Thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast for me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go?" Don't miss at this point the gravity of this confrontation. Pharaoh thinks he's the God of Egypt, the master of the Hebrews. He decides when they work, when they eat, when they rest. And here comes this couple of chops called Moses and Aaron making demands of him in the name of the slave people's God. So it goes on, "I do not know the Lord. Moreover, I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go on three days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens." And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens." The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, but the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle." Therefore, they cry, "Let us go and sacrifice and offer sacrifice to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men that they may labor at it and pay no regard to these lying words." Pharaoh strikes back, and he strikes back hard. Hear his intent. It wasn't to get more productivity out of the Israelites. They weren't expected to make any more bricks than before. It was to strike fear into their hearts, to keep them busy, to push them down, that they would have no energy or time to entertain ideas of deliverance. It was to brainwash them into believing that the truths Moses told them of God were lies, and to flaunt his power as the God of Egypt. Second observation this morning. is that fresh obedience and worship to God is always met with fresh opposition. This isn't what they wanted. This isn't the Hollywood ending that we all expected. Pharaoh was supposed to say yes. The power of God was supposed to come sweeping in and change Pharaoh's heart, and we'd all be free. This isn't what we signed up for. No, God, you've got this one wrong. Mike Wilkerson says this: if our primary evidence that God is at work is based on our circumstances, then our faith is strained and we are blindsided by circumstances that fail to meet our expectations. God's picture of redemption is not always the one that we imagined. I think we've always been a bit like this. I think if you spoke to the early disciples when Jesus has arrived and he was going to bring his kingdom in, that very clearly involved overthrowing the Romans. That very clearly involved kicking out the Romans and reestablishing the state of Israel. That's what it meant, that he would come riding in on some charged stallion and he would lead a rebellion against the Romans. But Jesus rode in on a donkey and went to a brutal death on the cross. We pray the Lord's Prayer, your will be done on earth, when if we're honest with ourselves, we're kind of praying is, God, would you do my will on earth? Perhaps Jesus' prayer is best of all, Father, it's not my will, but yours be done. The people's hopes are dashed. As I begin to imagine what life is like for the Israelites, I kind of wondered this week, what is worse? Is it to have no hope? Or is it to be given a glimpse of hope, a promise of it, only to have it wiped away? What is worse? What do you do when your hopes are dashed? What do you do when your faith is challenged by a devastating turn of events? How do you respond? Do you charge to God? Do you continue to trust his promises of redemption, or do you charge God? This is not what I signed up for. This is not what I was expecting of a loving father. Maybe you try and deal with God. You create conditions that you can tolerate. I will follow you as long as it looks like this or like that. Do you wander away from God to find comfort elsewhere, even back to the very things that enslave you? Do we hold a picture of redemption in our lives and say, God, save me like this? Or do we say, God, I know you are good. Save me like you want to. But that's easier said than done, isn't it? Often we face tough circumstances, dashed hopes and disappointments, and here's our dilemma. God is unseen where our present circumstances stare us in the face and our fears are palpable. They're right there. So let's look at two responses to this situation. Let's look firstly at how did the people of Israel respond. We're in verse 15 of chapter 5. Then the foreman of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, and yet they say, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, and yet the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You are idle. That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Go now and work. No straw will be given you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks, your daily task each day." And then they met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge you, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Pharaoh's plan's working. They weren't thinking about deliverance anymore. They weren't thinking about the promises of God anymore. They were preoccupied
with mere survival. The foreman cried out to Pharaoh for mercy, but he refused to let up. And so they turned on Moses and blamed him for their worsening conditions. Ultimately, behind the blame of Moses was their resentment towards God. When faced with the dilemma of either trusting God for their freedom or seeking relief by appeasing Pharaoh, they chose Pharaoh and would rather return to normal slavery. Isn't it ironic? It was Pharaoh who brought this suffering on them. It was God who could bring them deliverance. And yet somehow the Israelites are finding themselves blaming God for their suffering whilst appealing to Pharaoh in the hope that he could be appeased and offer them some relief. God had become the enemy and Pharaoh had become the ally. Can you see the deceptiveness and trickery of the work of the enemy here? God had become the enemy. There's a 1980s band called Depeche Mode, of which I was a fan. I'm giving my age away now. 1984, they wrote a song. They wrote a song because a friend of the band, at the age of 16 years old, had tried to commit suicide. They didn't succeed. And then within the next two years, this young person had radically given their life to Christ and was living for him. And then only to be killed in a road traffic accident 2 years later. And they wrote this song, and it said this: I don't want to start any blasphemous rumors, but I think that God's got a sick sense of humor. And when I die, I expect to find him laughing. They were looking at this girl, this friend, who'd hit rock bottom, hadn't been successful in committing suicide, had come to faith in Jesus, but then only to be killed in a road traffic accident. And they blamed God. I can almost hear the Israelites singing the same song. I don't want to start any blasphemous rumors, but I think that God's got a sick sense of humor. And when I die, I expect to find him laughing. That was the Israelites' response. But what was Moses' response? I mean, this is Moses' worst nightmare. Moses cried out to God in his distress. Oh, Lord, why have you done evil to these people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's done evil to the people, and you haven't delivered your people after all. What is this prayer about? Commentators are fairly split on this, some thinking this is a real prayer of doubt by Moses, others saying it's a prayer of faith. They argue about it. He certainly seems bewildered. He certainly seems shaken. There's a couple of things to notice about this. Oh, Lord, the word he uses there, Lord, Adonai, master, ultimately recognizing in that address that God is his master, that he is in control and he is in charge. And shaken though he was, he directs his cries to God, to the right master who can save his people. Moses here is lamenting. Crying out to God in faith means brutal honesty with God about your suffering, while still trusting him. And it's so vital when we face days of hopelessness, days of difficulty, and days of despair. As Mark drops the kids off from school and he drives around the corner and then he parks the car, and there's brutal pain and honesty with God. We see it throughout the Bible in the Psalms, Psalm 88. Lord, why do you reject me and hide your face from me? In chapter 44, why do you hide your face and forget my misery? In chapter 10, Lord, why do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In chapter 42, I say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Why must I go about mourning and oppressed by the enemy? Job asked why in chapter 13. God, why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Jesus on the cross. My God,
why have you forsaken me? Moses here is both full of faith and full of anguish, and we can be both. The Bible gives us permission to be both, to be full of faith and full of anxiety, of anguish, to be full of despair and to be full of disappointment. Crushed and broken, we need to come to our Heavenly Father. And he gives us permission to ask why. But we need to come in faith. We need to come recognizing that God is God, that he is in control, that in him we live and move and have our being. In him, all things hold together. I discovered what it means to lament after my brother Matt died. Also in a car accident, traffic accident. And I found great comfort in writing my own psalms. I think I've shared this before. But I used to write them down and write them in my journal. And I used to usually start off with this phrase, Lord, today I feel. And I used to tell God how I felt. And a bit like Moses, it was brutal honesty. In my pain and in my anguish and in my grief and in my brokenness, I told God. God, this is how I feel. And when I'd come to an end of telling God how I feel, I would then write the line, but I know that. But I know that. And I would write down truths about God and characteristics of God and things that I knew from the Bible that even though I didn't feel them in the emotion, I knew them. In my head, I knew them from experience. I knew them from my past. So I will. And I allowed my knowledge of God to shape my actions, not my circumstances. And I found writing these psalms so helpful because what I realized was that I needed to pursue God. I needed to find God. In the midst of my suffering, I needed to know God and know his character because I can rely on that. And my final observation this morning is this. We trust the character of God over the actions or the circumstances that we experience. We trust the character of God. If we look at God through the lens of our circumstances, we are in trouble. If we look through our circumstances through the lens of God, then we are secure. I often use Elizabeth Elliot's quote. I'll put it in again because it's so helpful. Happiness is Christ in me, not me in a different set of circumstances. Where this morning are you feeling frustrated, disappointed, discouraged, disconnected? Where are you full of grief and hopelessness? Are you going to respond like the people of Israel or are you going to respond like Moses? God, this is rubbish, but you are Adonai, my God, my master, my Lord, so I will put my faith in that. Crying out in faith means brutal honesty with God about your suffering whilst still trusting him. Moses gives us a hint of this in his prayer, but Jesus' cry from the cross was filled with far greater pain and far more faith. Jesus' expression of anguish was raw, honest, and fitting with his circumstances. And yet at first glance, it might not feel like a cry of faith at all. My God, why have you forsaken me? But Jesus was actually quoting from Psalm 22. Well, he wasn't just quoting it, he was living it. Psalm 22 says this, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? So far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest. You are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one of Israel's praises. In you, our ancestors put their trust, and they trusted in you to deliver them. To you, they cried out and were saved. In you, they trusted and we're not put to shame. Mark Wilkinson again. Jesus experienced worse pain than you and I will ever know. We will never know abandonment from God, and yet he faced it and didn't stop believing. Did Jesus' cry of faith fix his circumstances? No. He spoke these despairing words in the face of death, and then he died. And because Jesus faced the worst death, you will never have to. And we cling to the same promises that he did. We can face seemingly emotional, spiritual, or even physical death, knowing that God will deliver. For me this week, as God has brought me through that valley of the shadow of death, after my father and my brother died, my best mate, I know we've been praying for, went for his scan results. Only to find the cancer is inoperable and that his future, on this earth at least, is quite bleak. And as we chatted this week, and he said, "Stephen, I feel wretched. Just had his eighth round of chemo, ninth round of chemo," and he said, "I feel absolutely wretched, but I have Jesus. So how bad can it be?" And as we talked and as we shared, as we cried together, we listened to a song which really just summed up, I think, how we both felt. And I wanted to land it, this preach, with this song, because I think it captures everything that I feel in this storm. And whatever storm you might be in, maybe it captures a little bit of the sense of holding on to God in the storm. Can we just play this?
Sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again, I say amen, and it's still raining. But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm as your mercy falls, I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives and takes away. And I'll praise you in this storm, and I will lift my hands. For you are who you are, no matter where I am. And every tear I've cried, you hold in your hand. Never left my side, and though my heart is torn, I'ma praise you in the storm. I remember when I stumbled in the wind, you heard my cry to you and raised me up again. My strength is almost gone. How can I carry on if I can't find you? But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm with you. And as your mercy falls, I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives takes away.
Where in life, in your circumstances, are they difficult and challenging? For a straight choice this morning. Shall we not respond like the people did? Let's not run to comfort to Pharaoh whilst blaming God. Let's cry to God in brutal honesty as Moses did, as Jesus did. Said in that last song, I lift my eyes to the hills, where does my help come from? And at an end of a message like this, we need to lift our eyes to Jesus. And we need to be able to praise him through the storm. And we do that by remembering who he is and that he is great. And so we're going to finish with the declaration that God, you are great. You're great now. You always have been and you will be. Until that great day when he puts all things right. Let's stand and sing.